First, I want to just say it is a pleasure to be here today. This is an important topic that I think we're all focusing on these days, that we're concentrating on in terms of the realm of inclusive markets writ large. And over the years, USAID has been a significant partner with CGAP and looking at the microfinance side of things. And today's conversation is particularly important because of the customer centricity aspect of what we're looking at, the consumer aspect of microfinance. And I think this is a growing area of interest, and it makes a lot of sense. And I'll have to say, pardon me if I'm going to duplicate what you said, but the brief here, I received it, I don't know, a while back, but the brief that they've provided on your chairs is very interesting as well, and I encourage everybody to read that. So without further ado, I want to introduce everybody to our two guests today. The first is Tanaya Kilhara, who is a member of CGAP's client centricity team. She's been with CGAP since 2010 and leads its work on translating consumer insights into improved delivery of financial services. Before joining CGAP, she spent 4 years working on a startup urban microfinance institution in India, and she has her MBA from University of Pennsylvania School of Wharton School. And next, we are very happy to have Monique here, Monique Cohen, who is one of the world's leading experts in client-centered financial services for the poor. Monique has a strong, long, and distinguished career in development, including 8 years as a technical advisor of the Office of Microenterprise Development at USAID, before founding her own organization, Microfinance Opportunities, in 2002. She has a PhD in economic geography from Clark University. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming our guest today.
Great. I think I'll kick us off then. So welcome, everybody. Thank you so much, Heath, Jennifer, online, Angelina, for having us here today. It's really a pleasure to be with all of you. And I'm not sure where the camera is, but hello to our webinar guests as well. My name is Tanaya Kilhara, and I work on our customer centricity team at CGAP, and we've been thinking about this issue of customer centricity for financial inclusion. So very excited to be with you all today, share, you know, where we are in this journey, and really looking forward to hearing your perspectives as we get started with the conversation as well. So I'm good. So I'll start off by giving you just a brief background on financial inclusion and the role that CGAP plays, because I know we have a fairly varied audience here. Some of you who are deep into financial inclusion, that's what you do full time. Some of you work on other very, very interesting aspects of development which have obvious links into financial inclusion. But then I'll dive into the challenges that customers face when they're trying to access formal financial services and the challenges that providers of those financial services face, which are really the challenges to financial inclusion at this point of time. And that should hopefully set the stage and make clear why customer centricity is important as a new paradigm or a business model for financial institutions serving the poor. And then I'll share some of the experiences we've had on this topic. So just let's start with just some numbers to frame this discussion. And I'm sure you've seen all these numbers in different contexts, but just wanted to put it together. One in two people lives and works in the informal economy, if you look across the world. More than 40% earn less than $2 a day, and half the world does not have a formal financial account. And I want to zero in on this 50% without a formal financial account number. If you look at this number worldwide, it's 50%. And this graph we have up here is the percentage of people who have a formal financial account. Right? So the inverse of this is what is the people who do not have a formal financial account. And if you look in some regions, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, in the Middle East and North Africa, in parts of South Asia, you know, that 50% figure actually camouflages that 4 out of 5 people, 4 out of 5 adults are actually financially excluded. So at CGAP, that's our mandate. So the CGAP is a global partnership that seeks to advance formal financial inclusion. And really, CGAP has been in existence for almost 2 decades now. And we've seen the evolution of this industry from very narrow microcredit to micro-entrepreneurs to the field evolving to a broader set of financial services. So whether that's a range of credit services, saving, micro insurance, payments, pension, so a broader range of services. And we've also seen a new range of players delivering these services. So from microfinance institutions to, larger banks getting interested to telecom operators to retailers. So really, there are a broader range of players here than there have been before. And really, these are very big strides that have been made in financial inclusion. But the challenge in front of us is still vast, right? We have 50% of adults who do not have formal financial accounts. In some places in the world, that's 80% of adults who do not have formal financial accounts. And so we said, if things go on as usual, if it's business as usual, we will not see the kind of progress that we actually need to see. And so that's really the frame for this discussion. So, and I'm going to talk now a little bit about, if people could have accessed formal financial services, why aren't more people actually in the formal financial system? What are the challenges that customers or users of formal financial services actually face? And on the provider side, for institutions that are providing financial services, what are those challenges? So, especially as this new range of players has entered the provision of formal financial services for the poor, there's a tendency to take, what worked for middle-class customers and say, it must be similar and we'll just offer those same products and services just to a new segment. Now we'll offer this to this, lower income segment and things should work just fine. In this brief that Beth Ryan and I just published that's on your chair, we say really the bottom of the pyramid customers are fundamentally different from their middle-class counterparts along 4 dimensions. The first is along informal, irregular income. So consumers in lower income consumers do not have the same steady wages that their middle class counterparts have. Their wages are more subject to seasonality. They're micro entrepreneurs. There's a large mingling of business and household incomes and expenditures. The second dimension is along their spending and consumption patterns. So a larger portion of their spending is actually taken up by just their basic needs. They spend and consume in different places from where the middle class spends and consumes. So, where the middle class might consume in more formal retail, large retail chains, a lower income consumer might have more of their consumption at the local mom and pop store, and that has implications for the delivery of financial services. The third dimension is their relationships with informal financial service providers. So lower income consumers or bottom of the pyramid consumers it's not that they do not have access to financial services. They currently have financial relationships. These are just not in the formal financial system. And informal financial services, are more expensive typically, are exploitative. But on the other hand, informal financial service providers actually, in many ways, are quite linked in and connected to what the customer needs. I'll share with you a story I heard from someone in India. They said, in India, gold is a big thing, right? People buy a lot of gold across socioeconomic classes. And gold is both, a saving investment device, but it's also a status symbol. So when people need money and there's an emergency or they need access to cash, they actually pawn their gold. So they go to a money lender and pawn the gold. And I heard the story about how money lenders will actually give customers their gold back when they really need it. So say they have to go to a wedding, right? And you can't go to a wedding without all your jewelry on. It's a status symbol. So the moneylenders will stand outside the wedding entrance, give the customers their gold. Customers will go in with their full gold on, so their image is actually maintained in the society in which they live. As they come out, the moneylenders waiting behind the fence to take the jewelry back. And that's really extremely customized at the place where they needed delivery of financial services. So I'm just saying there's a bar that formal financial services actually have to meet and jump over when you look at alternatives. And the last dimension is that bottom of the pyramid customers actually have a greater need for consumer protection as they enter the formal financial system, because it's their new entrance into the system and the system is new. So that's really on the customer side of the equation. Let's then look at the provider side of the equation. So whether you look across products, you know, whether you look at mobile money deployments, you look at insurance policies, you look at savings products, across the range of products, what providers of financial services to the poor have experienced is that people either, you know, sign up for an insurance policy, they register for a mobile money account, but then people don't use it. And this really, so there's high levels, you have high dormancy, you have high levels of inactivity, you have insurance policy lapses. Even in microcredit and microfinance, you see dropout of customers. And this actually keeps that circle going. You keep having lower levels of financial inclusion. And on the provider side, this has a big impact, because for any product other than credit, and even for credit to a certain extent, the business model of providers really counts on usage, on transactions happening, on people, on customers staying loyal to the system and continuously using products and services. And so what happens then is that, you know, providers say this segment is not profitable, I can't serve this segment profitably, but the problem is really with usage. And so this really calls for a different approach to the design and delivery of formal financial services, one that's more customer-centric. And for a majority of financial service providers, this actually means improving the overall customer experience, changing the basis for their engagement with customers, and designing products and services and the entire customer experience based on what customers value and what they prefer. Right? And I'll come back to this thought in a bit. So we've skated around this issue. We've heard the term customer centricity. The whole seminar is about customer centricity for financial inclusion. So I thought it's useful for us to just have a working definition up for when we say customer centricity, what do we actually mean? And, you know, there are a number of definitions out there. We've chosen one that we think has the right elements, but this is completely open to how you want to interpret it. So the definition is up here. There are a couple of elements that I want to call your attention to. The first is really customer centricity as a business model operationalized through organizational structures, processes, systems, and measures. So it's not customer centricity as charity. It's not let me be good to customers. It's I'm doing something good. It's really I'm serving customers. As a financial service provider, I'm serving customers. And designing a customer experience that is really valuable for them and it's a win for me. That actually helps my business model. So you've heard me say this a couple of times now. Really, this business model enables an organization to provide a distinctive customer experience that responds to customers' wants and needs and that generates value that can be grown and sustained over the long term for a range of company stakeholders. So for customers, for their shareholders, for suppliers, for employees, for the stakeholders that the institution operates with. And so really it's about an ecosystem approach and not a single, institutional approach. Okay. So let's look at then what's the difference between the current model and the model that we're talking about today, customer centricity. So if you look on your left, If you look on your left, that is a product-centric approach, right? And these are this is the approach we have typically had in the financial inclusion industry, where you know institutions are constantly pushing out new products. These products don't really respond or address customer needs. Since it doesn't respond to customer needs, customers continue using their informal financial services and never quite make the leap and don't use products that even if they sign up for. And this results in dormancy, inactive accounts, mobile wallets that are just not used, and which leads to a fundamentally flawed business model for providers. And then it's really a vicious circle because they say, okay, this product's not working, let me put the next product out. And then you keep getting in that same vicious circle. On the right, you see the model that we are saying would actually make a difference, where a customer-centric approach starts with listening to customers, understanding what the customer challenges are and what needs to be facilitated in customers' lives. The resultant products are then chosen. They're chosen and they're bought by customers. They're not sold or pushed. Customers actually use it and see value from it. And because of that constant use, the choice and usage, this brings scale and revenue for providers. So again, just want to say this really is a business model that we're talking about. So we often hear from financial service providers, they say, yeah, we can't disagree with, you know, we can't disagree with customer centricity. This makes sense. But how do I actually operationalize it? What does this mean for me in practice? So we did a piece of research, and you should see outputs from it early next year, around saying, okay, you know, customer centricity might be a newer concept for our industry, but there's a rich body of literature and work and experience outside our industry. You know, the Amazons and Zappos and Procter & Gamble's of the world are very good at this. They've you know, learned over time, they've practiced it, and so what can we actually learn from other, industries? And so one of the big learnings was that it's about the entire business model. You can't, it's not a piecemeal, there's just one thing I need to do and then I'm customer centric. It really requires a fundamental reorientation of the entire organization around these five pillars. So you'll see at the core of this model is the customer experience, because that's what is distinctive, right? You're providing a customer experience that meets customer needs at the customer level, right? So it starts with, you put the customer at the core, you actually learn from customers, you understand customer data, there's, you listen to the voice of staff when you actually do this, you design the experience that's inclusive of product, but not limited to the product, because financial services is a service business, and there are a number of touch points at which customers actually interact with a financial institution. So actually looking at what's that customer experience across those touch points. So it's about the entire experience and not just the product. And then really empowering the customer with what they need to be able to interact effectively with the product, to be able to use the product in a way that adds value to their lives. And customer experience is not a one-shot, you know, let me do it at the point at which I launch the product, but it's really managing that customer experience over the relationship or over the lifetime of the relationship with the customer. Now to deliver this customer experience, you could say, you know, all I need is to train my frontline staff in a way that they deliver the customer experience and then all is good. But, I mean, all of you who have interacted with institutions will recognize that, you know, that just doesn't work. For your frontline staff to be able to deliver a certain customer experience, you actually need different parts of the organization aligned. So the big part is leadership and culture. And we've seen this repeatedly. It's really about strong leaders driving a change in culture on this issue. You know, in Procter & Gamble, for instance, when Procter & Gamble was actually seeing a drop in profits, was seeing drop in market share, and they had their new CEO, Lafley, come in. This was not this time when he came in, but this was about 20 years ago when he came in. And what he did was he said, okay, I believe that what will help our business model is to really refocus around the customer. But I don't think this is a massive organization I have here, and to shift this whole ship is a big issue. So what I'll do is I'll pick one piece of the organization. I'll pick one product, and I'll work with that product. So he worked with the product manager of that product to go out to understand customers, to redesign the experience for that customer based on what the customer wants, and then drove sales of that product based on that customer understanding. And that's, you know, the product sales tripled to 3 or 4 times. And then he used that then as a demonstration for the rest of the organization and said, you know, look at what is available at a business level for you if this is the approach that you take. So really strong leadership driving it. The second piece you have there is around the operating model. So it's really not just about your frontline staff, but it's about departments that you would think are traditionally not customer facing. These are departments like your MIS department, your compliance department, your IT department. Because if your frontline staff have to deliver a certain customer experience, you need to have the processes in place for that. Who drives the processes are all the back end, what are traditionally back end functions. So unless the other functions are actually cognizant of what the customer wants and the kind of customer experience you're trying to deliver, there's no way you will be able to design and deliver that. Your people, we've talked already about your frontline staff, and really frontline staff acting not as champions for the institution, but as advocates or champions for the customer within the organization. And then providing them with the tools that they require to actually be able to do this. So one of the tools we talk about is an insights engine. So how do you find a way to systematically bring insights into your institution, customer insights into the institution, and then have them used by the institution? And I'll come back to this a little later. And the last pillar we have there is around value creation. So this is both measuring whether you're creating value for the customer. So are you reducing the cost that it takes for a customer to interact with your financial institution? Because it's expensive for customers to interact with formal financial services. There's a direct cost they have. There's, you know, other economic costs they have. They have to sacrifice wages and, you know, travel on a bus and come and stand in a bank branch in a line, and they lose wages. There are, in some contexts, religious or cultural costs to actually accessing from formal financial services. If you're from an Islamic society and your religion doesn't allow you to pay interest, but that's the only way for you to access, there's a religious cost that you pay. There are other costs like psychological costs. We all, you know, there's research around stress and the effects of stress on people, and debt often causes stress. So really, are you measuring, can you reduce the cost that it takes for a customer to interact with the institution? And the other side of the value creation is there also value for the business? So is there a business case, and are you actively, are there metrics that you're measuring to see that there's business value from this approach for your institution? So I'm going to stop here because I know I've thrown a lot of information at you. So maybe we can just pause for about 5 minutes, take any questions, comments you have about the model, or just experiences you have to share. Does this resonate? What are the things you're thinking about? Yes, sir, please.
The first one is, there was a reference on the slide to the customer center.
I have two questions. The first, my name is Dan Silverstein. I'm with USAID and the Bureau for Food Security. There was a reference on one of the slides to the customer-centric blueprint. Do you know where we can find that? Okay. And so I'd like to know at some point this morning.
And
the second question is, you're speaking a great deal about finding out from the customer what it is that they need. How do you do that? Thanks.
Angelina, should I just answer the question or wait for more questions? What would you rather I do? Okay, great. So the customer-centric blueprint is a book written by an author called Doug Leather, whose quote was up on the site. It's available on Amazon. That is an easy question. And the next question, I think, about how do you actually understand customers, I'm going to just pause on that because I know Monique is going to talk a lot about that, but there's a number of ways to do that, to really use your frontline staff to do it, to use the data that you have to do it, to go out and do. We've experimented, and I'll talk about that when we talk about projects, with human-centered design, and so a really, you know, a very deep approach, ethnographic approach to understanding customers. But I will that's all I'll say for now, just as a teaser, and I know Monique will come back to it.
Tanaya, there's a question here from Stephen Muhangi from Kampala, Uganda, from our webinar. Thank you so much for joining. And his question is, asks about internal infrastructure being a bottleneck to adopting this model.
Absolutely. So I think, and I think that is one of the biggest bottlenecks, is there's you have the machinery, and you have a ship that's moving, and you have a and you have an institution that's optimized for efficiency, and there's a lot of effort that institutions have put into to really being efficient in delivering services in a certain way. And I think this, the approach actually requires a reorientation. So I think one of the things we say is, don't, you know, it looks very overwhelming when you look at the entire model and making all these changes at once. So I think the trick is to see in your institution what would be the really the key leverage points that you need, that would really make the biggest difference. So in some institutions, it might be what we need is a change in culture. In some other institutions, it might be, you know, I think the culture is actually a pretty innovative, you know, learning kind of culture. But what we really need is to figure out, we have no way of getting customer insights into the organization. So what I need to invest in is a way for me to bring customer insights into the organization. So I think there are different starting points for this journey based on the institutional context. And Herat, please. I have a colleague here who leads our team on customer centricity. So
maybe we must just add that we're also thinking about the diagnostic. So if you look at an institution and you want to assess the institution to see where are the points that you start working, one way is sort of to run the diagnostic across the institution and all its facets and departments, and then use that as a base for your decision.
Hi, Mariola from Mix. My question is, in this customer-centric business model, which for me appears more or less pretty standardized, mm-hmm. I'm wondering what level or what room or what, how much flexibility is there for any level of customization?
I actually think the model is completely customizable, because if you look at those pieces, if you look at the pillars, those are really pretty broad buckets, and what each of these pillars looks like within an organization is very different. So let me give you an example. So if you take two companies that are actually now owned by the same people, Zappos and Amazon, right? The Amazon, and they're both, you know, well-recognized as extremely customer-centric institutions. The Amazon approach is completely around data. So you will not find, you don't find their staff talking to customers, but they have a whole lot of data about their customers, and their approach is around mining that data, understanding that data very well, and then using that to drive operations, right? So it's a very specific type of model. You look at a Zappos model, it's, you know, and you talk to Zappos about metrics, they're like, no, what we really care about is providing a wow experience for our customers. I know I can't say V and W properly, so you have to excuse me. So that's what they're all about, right? So what they invest in is their call center. And so if customers call their call center, the metrics they have are completely different from any other call center. The metrics they have is your customer needs to leave delighted at the end of the call, not the number of minutes that you spend on the phone or getting off the phone as soon as possible. And I was reading recently, Zappos actually doesn't pay their call center employees any differently from anyone else in the market. But what they allow them to do is they say you have decision-making power when you have a conversation with the customer, and you're allowed to be yourself. You're allowed to actually express your personality in that call. And so employees are extremely empowered. They're, you know, completely able to be advocates for the customer because they've been empowered. So I think when you take this model and what you do with it is very different based on what kind of institution you are.
We'll take a couple more questions, one from the webinar. So there's a conversation happening on the webinar between, Nicole, joining us, I believe, from Uganda, Lorenz Wild, and also Graham White, right, about using surveys as a method to find a more customizable product. And Graham's comment is he would be careful or cautious of using surveys, but if you want to understand complex human financial behavior, you need to use qualitative research approaches as well, and that's something that Michael Fryer as well has been commenting that deep dive interviews also help provide varying results for the surveys as well.
So this is another one I know Monique will come back to, but let me just say this. I think there's a lot of discussion we have around which approach is better, is qualitative better than quantitative, but I think that's the wrong question, right? The question is really what research methods to answer what question, right? So it is, I think, in our experience, what we found, and we are really pretty agnostic around approach, and we like to use a number of approaches together because we think these are complex problems that we're looking to solve. Right? So in our experience, what we've found is that when you want to, blue sky, really understand the customer deeply and be creative around the customer, qualitative approaches are great. You know, this human-centered design approaches, the anthropological approaches, and, you know, all of those qualitative approaches really matter. But as you then start, but it really helps then to validate what you're learning from qualitative approaches through quantitative methods. And then at the institutional level, when you want to take something to your board, it's very difficult to say, I spoke to 6 customers and that's what they told me. Even though you speak to people, they will say after 12, 14 interviews, you start hearing the same themes. So these are valid, but it's very hard to convince a board this is valid based on 12 interviews. So I think it's really the question is to use these methods smartly together, and where you need qualitative and where you need quantitative. And I'll stop there.
Hi, Glimmernet from, Glimmernet from Practical Action. Hello. I guess the question that I have, I know that a lot of different companies, when they're usually using a customer experience approach, they're usually approaching it with kind of a life cycle approach, where they're thinking about the way that the customer goes through that life cycle. Yeah. But you were also talking about how, in many ways, the type of work that most of the people in this room do really focuses more outside of the company, so there's more of an ecosystem. So I was wondering if you could talk about how the customer experience approach plugs into that larger ecosystem.
It's a great question. It's a great question, and I don't know I have a simple answer for you. What I will say is that from speaking to companies across industries, I think the direction most industries are moving in is actually an ecosystem approach. It's no longer, one institution being able to deliver services to customers. It's similar in financial services, right? They're more and more, I think, we're going to see partnerships and really not one provider being able to provide every financial services. For instance, you're seeing telecom operators coming together with retailers, coming together with banks to actually deliver a range of services. So then they can deliver payments and they can deliver pensions and insurance all as a basket. And at the front end, the customer might just see one face, but in the background, there are a number of players. Similarly with Amazon, for instance, right? Your customer sees Amazon, but in the back end, there are any number of partnerships. And I think being able to manage this complex ecosystem of partnerships, so where, for instance, we said people and their tools, often, and now even in financial services, often the person who's interacting with a customer is not your employee. It's an agent, for instance, if you talk about mobile banking. So how do you manage this ecosystem where everyone you're interacting with or everyone who has a customer interaction is not necessarily your employee? And I think those are questions that, as an industry, and I don't think there are simple answers to it. I think we have to grapple with these issues and figure them out.
One last question. Question or comment. I'm Peter Graves from the World Council of Credit Unions. Credit unions serve about 208 million members around the world. The customer centricity is core to credit union membership. So much of this has been done for the last 40 years, 50 years of credit unions. I'm wondering if in your research you even touched upon credit unions. In your material, there's only 2 mentions of savings and nothing of SACOs or credit unions. In Kenya, you have approximately $13 to $14 billion worth of savings, and a third of that is in SACOs.
It's a... I think that's a great point. What I will say is in the research that we've done, so far we actually focused pretty much more or less outside financial inclusion. So now we're actually getting to a point where we're looking intensively at financial inclusion. So absolutely agree with you that credit unions should be a part of this conversation. Great. So just wanted to share a couple of experiences with you. I know we're hearing a lot of buzz in our industry these days, and I think even more broadly around human-centered design. So just wanted to talk a little bit about work that we've done there. So, you know, our journey about 3 years ago, we looked at it and we said, yeah, there is clearly this issue with customers using and accepting and using, especially branchless banking financial services. And our thought at that point was, you know, the problem is that the right products are not out there. Right? We don't have products that really respond to customer needs, and so what you need is disruptive innovation, and that will actually solve the issue that we're having in financial inclusion. And so we did at that point, you know, a number of projects across geographies. So we did projects in Brazil, in Mexico, in Kenya, in Uganda, in Ghana, in Indonesia. We used human-centered design methodologies, and we worked with a range of providers. So we worked with large telecom operators, with larger banks, smaller banks, but people who were actually in the branchless banking environment. And out of these projects, actually ended up designing a variety of products. So savings products, insurance products, payments products. So quite the range, and like I mentioned, through it all, used this human-centered design methodology, which really involves spending in-depth, great amounts of time with the customer, very observation-based. So you're actually watching customers interact in their own environment versus, you know, having them in a focus group or a survey. It's more one-to-one. I think some of the real interesting things about human-centered design is how they synthesize insights about customers and how you actually prototype, you know, rapidly prototype ideas, so you don't wait till you get all the way to a fully defined product before you start testing it with customers. As you're thinking, you actually test it with customers. So we really gained a number of rich insights into the needs and behaviors of customers globally. And we also designed and prototyped products that customers really liked. Now, here's the funny thing that happened. What we saw was, you know, we prototyped these great products, consumers liked it, and then we handed it off, institutions took it over to, you know, take it through their machinery and launch it or scale it. And what we saw is when it went into the machinery, when it went to the IT department and the compliance department and the marketing department, what came out at the other end looked exactly like every other product they had launched. Right? And it was really a moment of learning for us that you actually need the entire weight of an organization around a customer-centric approach to sustainably deliver a superior customer experience for customers. Right? So really learned a lot, and that was one of our learnings. And so towards the end of those projects, you know, towards the second half of those projects that we did, we actually incorporated much more of elements of saying, you know, it's not enough to just hand it off, but let's follow that the cycle through. Also building on that, we're actually currently partnering with a microfinance institution in India. And this institution has over 1 million customers. And they're quite actively on this journey to customer centricity. You know, there is high level buy-in. They're driving to actually deliver that full package. And their starting point was, you know, it's a microfinance institution in India. And in India, it's really predominantly a group loan business. So they had these over 1 million customers, but these were, you know, all customers in joint liability groups. So the starting point was they recognized that you know, we can't suddenly one day start, you know, being customer-centric for this whole segment of customers that we have. So our starting point should be to actually segment our customers. So let's segment. So they segmented, and then they picked one segment that they called the accelerator segment, which who are really high-growth micro-enterprise owners, high-growth potential micro-enterprise owners, whether they're high-growth currently or not. And then they said, for this one segment of customers, let's figure out what it means to be customer-centric. So let's actually see if we can deliver the entire range of financial services to them. Let's see if we can offer financial advice. Let's see if we can customize delivery channels for this segment of customers. And that's the point at which we started our partnership with Janalakshmi. And in the first phase, what we did with them is what I was talking about, designing an insights engine for the organization. So we said, you know, what will be fundamental is for you to find a way to systematically and consistently bring insights into the organization. And we ended up designing something called Kaleido, and you'll find more about it on our website. So please go check it out. And I think there are brochures about it outside as well. You know, following that, they're also actually actively engaged in a number of other initiatives to implement customer centricity. One of the things they've set up is a customer centricity council, which has the heads of all the departments come together once a month to actually discuss the customer and see, and you know, have the customer be a central part of that conversation. They're designing delivery channels to get closer and add more value to customers' lives. But they will be the first ones to tell you that they're right at the beginning of this journey to customer centricity. And I really want to emphasize, and it's probably a good note to close on, that it's a journey. It's not, you know, one day I'm not customer centric, next day I turn on a switch, I am. It is a journey, and incremental steps really make a difference over time. And you can watch more about Janalakshmi. We have a video about it on our website, so afterwards please do go check it out. And I'm going to just close quickly with two things. One is just to tell you about our approach to this issue at CGAP. As you know, CGAP is a global learning partnership, so we really want to influence the industry in this direction. And what we're working on is a guide to customer centricity as a business model. And this is a collaborative, open-source guide that we're looking to build, so really would love for, you know, those of you who are interested to participate with us in this process. Once we have the guide, we'll actually demonstrate and, you know, test this guide with financial institutions in the field. Not a lot, 3 or 4 financial institutions partners over the next few years, and then really learn from that and take the approach to scale. To build this open source guide, we've created something we're calling the CGAP Customers at the Center workspace. You can access it at workspace.cgap.org. The URL is up there. And really, the workspace is a collaboration space, or, you know, like a sandbox kind of environment is how we like to think of it. So please do, you'll find a number of groups there with different projects along the along each of the pillars. So do join us and contribute. We really look forward to keeping this conversation going and learning with you. I will stop there and hand over to Monique. Thank you so much.
So I called this putting clients first, because essentially that's what it's about. And for those of you who knew about microfinance opportunities at the very beginning, that was our tagline. So I want to take off from where Tanaya's just ended and kind of delve in and delve more deeply into kind of some of the issues that I think are important. And I want to look particularly at what type of things do we need to know about clients? What is different about this? Because that should be our starting point. And the question was asked, what do we need to know and how do we need to analyze it? Well, let's look at how you would look at clients differently from what we've been doing traditionally. And let's drill down to that direction. Tanaya mentioned the challenges to financial inclusion, and one of them has been low usage rates. Now, for those of you who have been around a little while, you know that's not new. That has been around since the beginning of microcredit. We've always had this problem that more people sign up than actually use the products available. It's not a new problem. It just keeps recurring. And when times are bad, it even recurs more. And what's interesting to me about it is how the business talked about it. So first of all, it was retention. How do we do retention? And then there were the people who dropped out and or who didn't re-up, and they became deserters. So they were seen as, quote, unloyal. And so one, the response that we took to that was to do market research. That's when market research became important. And we did exit surveys. In fact, we developed them under the Ames Project at USAID, and they're wide, that's widely used. We did focus groups. We did a lot of things, PRA. We did, you name it, we did it. But what we were doing was looking at products and how people, what products people might need, and asking, how can we tweak what we have? And that was really our objective. And something you should think about, in those days, that was called being client-focused. So if you listen to Tanaya, we've come a long way from that particular point. So then we had the next phase, I think, was the arrival of digital financial services and savings. We saw the dormancy problem, and we saw that more people signed up than used accounts. I think GSMA, last I read, only 29% of all mobile banking accounts were active. That is a very small proportion. The other one I heard, the statistic I heard, was that of all the people who cash out, less than 40%, and I'm not exactly sure about the number, cash in. So most of the people take the money out, but they don't actually use the service. Another thing that happened, and we have to think about when we rethink clients, is as we think about digital financial services, and that's what our primary concern is right now, is people are going from high touch to low touch banking. And poor people like high touch. So we're giving them low touch, and the emphasis has moved from the number of transactions versus the size of a transaction. So if you were a client in an MFI, I suppose you would think that your institutional provider is becoming further and further away from you. And so we want to bring this back and create a better experience. So there's a real challenge to do that. Okay. Last month in Turin, there was a 3-day symposium on clients at the centre. And I also advised CGAP and was involved in running a workshop on client empowerment. And one of the questions we asked people in the room was, my organization is customer-centric and promotes customer empowerment. And we ask people to agree, disagree, strongly agree, or strongly disagree. And before I tell you what they said, has anybody got a comment they'd like to make about this statement, about their organization? Okay. It's all right. We'll move on. I mean, it's something you probably haven't thought about, but it's something you should be starting to think about if you're going to move in this direction. So what happened is we had four corners, you know, agree, disagree, whatever, strongly agree, strongly disagree. And most people went to the agree and strongly agree groups. And the implication was that we do know our market. We know all about clients, and this really works. Yet what became clear over the 3 days of the symposium, there was a refrain, and it all was, we don't understand our clients and their needs and their priorities, and which suggests, obviously, we don't know our clients. So it's kind of an interesting thought to where's that contradiction coming from. So on one hand, everybody thinks it's client-centric. On the other hand, they don't think they know anything. So what is putting clients first? So over the course of the 3 days of the symposium, it became kind of clear that what they thought was client-centric was what I referred to before, was a product-led approach, and they justified the success of their program by saying it appealed to clients and there was a big demand. That is very different than what Tanaya has been talking about and what I think is client-centric. But that's what where the state of the world is about this issue. And so in the course of a plenary, Greta Bull, who is an old friend of mine, she said, made the statement, and I kind of sat up and actually tweeted it because I was so amazed. She said, we need to think about our customers differently. So I thought about that, and it seems like it is time to shake things up and do some things differently. Last year, I spoke at the symposium, and I made the case that we need to begin to go beyond what has been the traditional view of clients as statistics and as passive. And we have to start thinking of them as dynamic. And somebody mentioned the life cycle. We haven't bothered with that until now, but we need to think how to grow with clients and how clients change as they age, their demands for financial services alters. Do we have the flexibility to respond in that way? We also, if we're going to talk about client centricity, we have to see clients as active. We have to see them as taking up a more active role and see them as players and drivers of financial institution and the business, that business. So what I want to talk about now is I want to explore a little bit a new perspective of thinking about clients, because the way we've been doing it till now, focusing on financial services according to a lot of market research, really hasn't delivered all the goods. Okay. So there are four variables I'm going to talk about. And they are issues that I have been exploring over the last year and trying to bring them together. So this is an exploratory work in progress. So in the traditional way we've approached things, we've thought about products only. And the top line, the hot vertical is the products. And we've thought about designing the right product and tweaking it. And sometimes we have too many products, sometimes we don't have enough products. But our focus has been on products. But things have begun to change. First of all, digital financial services are a different delivery system, even if they have the same products. Informal, they may deliver the same product, may offer the same product, but deliver it very differently. So it is time to relate the problem that you want to look at, but also the need to both the delivery channel and the product. And so how do you make that choice? And I think it's important to understand a lot about how people make choices. So one of the ways is to think about, first of all, what's the task that a poor person needs financial products for. So next is, when is it available? You know, the biggest complaint about a lot of microfinance clients is when they have an emergency. It's not that people don't have emergency loans, but they can't get the loan when they need it. And so they go back to the informal sector. So you need to think about that. You need to think about what's available. You need to think about the cost, an issue that CGAP is going to get into. And then what you have to think about is the sequence of transactions that has preceded it. What have people borrowed, saved, done prior to this? And what can they do as they move forward? The thing we have to remember, and tends to get lost because most of the experts sit in silos. You know, some people do microcredit, some do insurance, some do whatever, savings. And they're looking at their little silos, but clients don't live in silos. For them, life is one series of trade-offs. And it's a trade-off such as saving for emergencies, buying insurance, paying school fees. And this is the reality of financial decision-making for clients. And as new technologies develop, the type of offerings often creates a different context. And you have to think, how are they going to make the choices? The problem is we bring on board more digital finance, we have a group of people who are not equipped to do that and don't know how to make those trade-offs. Second point, moving beyond functionality. I said earlier that people use financial services to figure out the task they need to do. And experts on our side tend to look at financial services in terms of what function will they serve? Will they help me increase agricultural output? What does a smallholder need in a loan? And the implicit justification is that it will help the person do whatever better, the job better, and facilitate the cash flow. Well, with electronic financial services, the equation begins to change because we are asking people to leapfrog into a world of technology and banking which are unfamiliar. We're asking them to leapfrog from the informal sector to the formal, recognizing they may use both, leapfrog into banking, which for many people has a lot, poor people has negative experiences, into technology for the first time, go from bricks and mortar transactions to digital financial services, using credit and borrowing for specific purposes to mobile money, which is a transactional service. Now, don't underestimate it. I started my work on digital services quite a while ago, and I was in Malawi. And what I recognize is paramount that nobody should forget is that poor people want to be part of the 21st century. They want to be into digital services. They don't want to be left behind because they know they'll be left behind in every other thing as well. So they want to experience it and master it and use it. And I think we need to keep focused because we tend to forget that they aren't backward. They just want to be part of this. So they want to have the feel, the experience, but it's very overwhelming. And so it's faced a lot with trepidation. We, in Microfinance Opportunities, we just finished a project with three mobile banking operations. And we found this fear of entering into transactions that way was really governed by a fear of loss. Would I lose my money in a virtual environment? And that is really an important thing to think about. We automatically see the justification for this and why it's a better product, and they look at it and they see, what's the risk? What will I lose? I don't have very much money. I can't afford to lose it. Do I run a risk? And what we've learned is that people need time to settle in, to learn how to do it, to begin to build trust with the institution that's providing it, because often it's not banks, and they need to have a positive experience, which goes to the heart of experience. So there was always, has been on digital financial services an assumption by the experts, hey, this is really great, it will lower your costs, it will do all these great things, and people will gravitate towards them. But it's clear that these are learned behaviors and they don't happen very fast. So how many people here have read Portfolios of the Poor? Okay, how many of you, does anybody want to tell me one of their takeaways? Or if you read it long ago, can you remember?
Yeah. one of the main takeaways is that low-income people actually have very intricate money management skills.
I think that was one of the... Do I repeat that? As the low-income customers have very good and intricate money management skills.
Right.
So I think that was the main takeaway.
Anybody else want to comment? There are a few more hands. Well, they do have very good management skills, but they have it for a certain ecosystem and environment. And the question is, if you're going to introduce a wider range of products, particularly delivery systems, are they equipped for that? Do they have the skills?
I wonder if you could be a little bit more precise in your use of the term money management. Do you mean cash management?
Yes.
Or are you also talking about entrepreneurial investment capital?
I primarily mean cash flow management, because that is essentially at the essence of what poor people have to do. She mentioned, was it 50% of money goes on consumption? You know, that's the first thing. They move from crisis to crisis, and their skill is to reduce their vulnerability and protect the downside. And that is what is the risk that they face all the time. So that's my particular context. Okay. So with limited money and limited, but what's more important, they have limited discretionary money. So one of the things that one has to recognize is that one of the repeated benefits by the experts of digital financial services, you can save because that will help you do the manage your money better and manage emergencies. And yet that hasn't really happened. Yes, they're poor good, the poor are good money managers. They know how to put money aside. But too many shocks deplete their resources. And savings are hard to accumulate when the promise is, even when the promise is security and accessibility. Income levels and irregularities are primarily obstacles. You don't know when the money's coming in, and you might not know where the money is. And if you want to increase financial inclusion rates, we need to consider other behaviors and how they affect demand. And I've put up three here on the slide that bear on what I've just been talking about. You know, everybody wants people to save, and they think they should save, and they save in certain sorts of ways. But in the research that I've been involved in, I'm very struck by when you talk about budgeting and planning, very few people plan ahead. Poor people, I would argue, cannot afford to plan ahead. What they do is they plan backwards. So if you talk to them about budgeting, at the end of the month, what do? They look where the money went. How come I don't have anything left over? Then until they will have money left over, frankly, I don't think they're going to be able to plan ahead. So the challenge for us when we think about clients is to think about where is that point where they can begin to build a surplus. And the last variable is something that's cropped up several times. I've been involved in two sets of financial diaries, and I have to say I find them very exciting things to do and to analyze the data. But we should be clear, you know, the data is about weekly transactions recorded every week, inflows and outflows. And they're a valuable source about how people use financial resources and how they manage their money. They offer an opportunity to match product line, delivery channels, and market and target group. So you can see, remember the first matrix I had, you can look at the data that comes out of diaries and figure out what is going where, what delivery channel and what product. And it's not always what the experts assume. We often think, well, I'll use money this way or that way. Not necessarily. How many of you know the story of M-Pesa, which was started as a loan product? but in fact became a remittance product and a payments product. And that's where, but who figured it out? The clients, not the experts. So there was another product that came up and out of the diaries that we did in Malawi and in Kenya. That is something I don't think I would have ever thought of as a potential market. But if you listen to your clients you might, and look at the diaries data, which was that most of the transactions that we recorded, even though they were very small, were intra-family within one social network. And social networks are very important because it's a way of making sure the money goes where it wants. You can ask a businessman, did you get the money that I sent you? And he can say no. But if you ask a family member, they can't say no. They might try, but there's always going to be somebody who'll disagree. So in Malawi, cash gifts between family members added up to more than 7 times the number of transactions in commercial banks. And the data showed that 34 transactions per individual over a 73-week period. In Kenya, 84% of the cash gifts were below $50. And in both countries, the majority were with family networks and with people. And it's important to remember that these networks have played a dominant role. Yet, think about it for a minute. Small transactions, very frequent. No bank is more, bricks and mortar bank is going to pick that up. It's much too expensive. But it does work for digital financial services. If the pricing can be right, there's no reason it won't work. So I put there, it might not be what you think, because I think there is a lot of people who think why certain digital services will be good for the clients, but they forget to ask themselves, what does the client think? What would they use it for? And we need to find a way to introduce products and wait and see. So in conclusion, I do think you have to think about clients differently. And I've shown that it's more than just thinking about functionality. You've got to think about the networks. You've got to think about what experience people have. You have to think about the context in which they live. But we have to go beyond basically our traditional approach, understanding what product will help people do a task, and that's all. Because there are more variables around it. We have to think about empowerment and many of the things that were on the circles. The other thing we need to think about is when you leapfrog into this new world of digital finance, it might not be money management that you have to worry about. It might be the real issue, and that's what emerged from our work, is that trust and confidence are key. You need to build trust with new institutions, or clients need to build trust with new institutions, and the customers need to have successful experiences in using new financial products. There are enormous numbers of doubts about the risk they could incur, and they don't want them. However, we're all outsiders in this game, right? And we don't risk our money. So I would like to make a point of caution that we need to step back and learn from our customers and at the same time ensure that the customer experience is one in which they feel empowered to exercise choice, to act, particularly in the context of consumer protection, and can expect to be treated with respect. The goal that we're moving towards is an interactive customer-provider relationship that is a win-win for the customer and the financial institution. Thank you.